It's Philosophy Talk.
We've got a great name, we've got a great team, we've got a great logo, and we've got a great name. Now we just need an idea. Let's pivot. Let's pivot.
When techies talk about making the world a better place, what does better mean? And for whom?
When techies quote philosophy, do they get it right?
It's about how these industries present themselves to a broader public.
Can democracy survive the rhetoric of Silicon Valley?
Disruption always seems to miraculously not affect those in power.
Our guest is Adrian Daub from Stanford University, author of What Tech Calls Thinking.
These companies have, in some ways, transformed our value systems and have sort of created this way of thinking that makes what they do seem a lot more innocuous and a lot more self-evident than it really is.
The rhetoric of big tech, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Are tech companies really making the world a better place?
Does it take a genius to found a startup?
How can Silicon Valley believe its own hype?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from our respective living rooms via the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about the rhetoric of big tech.
You know, Silicon Valley may be full of so-called techies, but they sure have a lot of storytellers in their ranks.
I'm sensing some disdain for the tech industry there. I would have thought a literature guy like you would appreciate storytelling.
Oh, I love fictions, right? But you know, fictions are stories everyone knows aren't true. Whereas when big tech companies talk about making the world a better place, doing no evil, caring about social issues, that's not fiction. That's just lies.
No, but isn't some of it true? I mean, we have whole libraries at our fingertips, and we get to teach online while we shelter in place. And hey, we can talk to like-minded people from all over the world.
Oh, great. So you can find a global community of people who share your addiction to funny cat videos or whatever? Big whoop.
Hey, what have you got against cat videos? I mean, that one where the kitten plays the piano, it's really cute. Anyway, I don't think you can dismiss internet communities as frivolous. I mean, what about people from marginalized groups who live alone and isolated? Thanks to platforms like Twitter, they can find each other, connect, and organize politically.
Yeah, and with the same technology, like-minded extremists can find each other to share their toxic ideologies and organize violent riots.
Oh, you can't blame the internet companies for violent extremists. When terrorists send letters to each other, do you blame the post office?
Well, I don't know. Is the post office also sowing political division, selling outrage, and spreading misinformation while raking in the big bucks?
Oh, they're definitely not raking in the big bucks. Come on. Don't you think it's really politicians who are to blame for our political division?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, there's plenty of blame to go around, Ray. I mean, yeah, politicians, sure, but tech companies actively encourage trolling and bullying, or as they call it, engagement. And then they turn around and say it's not their responsibility when people do those exact things.
Whoa, I think you need to zoom out a bit and not get so caught up in what's happening right now in politics. I mean, why not think about the way software has transformed medical record keeping or library access?
And if you can get past the paywall.
Oh, come on. If it wasn't for the latest technology, Philosophy Talk wouldn't be on the air during a pandemic.
Oh, touche. Okay, fair enough. I'm not saying everything that comes out of the tech industry is bad. I just don't like the way they talk. It's all dropping out and disrupting. Whatever happened to staying in school and preserving stuff that's good?
Well, what's wrong with disrupting the status quo?
Well, the status quo includes drivers and food delivery people who now can't get employee benefits or earn a decent wage.
Yeah, okay. I see how tech has some bad consequences. But aren't techies just regular people just trying to get by in an economy that's hard for everybody?
That's not how they describe themselves, Ray. There's this whole mythology they've built up. All those archetypes they appeal to, like the genius iconoclast with the bold vision for the future. The plucky little startup taking on an industry Goliath.
Ah, there you go again, complaining about narratives. Admit it. that's what's really bothering you.
Well, yeah, I mean, these aren't fun fictions. They're dangerous deceptions. And all that mythologizing, it allows them to dodge responsibility for the problems they've helped to bring about.
Well, that's just what our guest thinks. It's Adrian Daub from Stanford. We'll be talking to him in just a bit. His new book, What Tech Calls Thinking, looks at the way Silicon Valley hides rapacious behavior with a veneer of shiny rhetoric.
Like, for example, Uber and Lyft. In 2020, they bankrolled an initiative in California, allowing companies to treat workers as independent contractors, giving them fewer benefits. But they phrased it as, get this, a civil rights issue. And they won.
So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to find out more. She files this report.
Sam Harnett is a tech and labor reporter at KQED in San Francisco. Although he sort of takes exception with the phrase tech reporter.
If you're covering the extractive capitalism happening at a major corporation that's just using the internet to make money and profit.
Many of the people who consider themselves tech journalists aren't really reporting on technology.
Like, what technology does Uber have? It has an app. I mean, even Google. I mean, Google's search algorithms, okay, you can construe that as technology, but really, they're gathering data and running an advertising business. So I think it's a stretch to call these journalists tech journalists when really what they are reporting on are corporations that are using the internet to make money.
Harnett is also the author of a paper entitled Words Matter, How Tech Media Helped Write Gig Companies into Existence. He's covered companies like Lyft for 7 years, almost since it was founded. Lyft gave drivers fuzzy pink mustaches and marketed itself as a tech company that put the power of sharing rides directly into people's hands.
Drivers with spare seats should be able to share them, make extra money, get paid on their own terms. And we'll give out giant pink mustaches for the front of every car.
Whoa, cowboy!
Food and grocery delivery companies like Instacart, DoorDash, and Postmates also emerged into the gig economy. Harnett remembers watching with alarm as words like pivot, rideshare, and collaborative consumption began to appear in news stories.
Sometimes these terms and rhetoric come out of the companies, and a lot of the times it came out of bad journalism. You know, like the term sharing economy, for example. Uber and Lyft weren't running advertisements with, you know, we are the sharing economy.
But they didn't need to. Reporters and pundits began describing this for them.
Companies like Uber and Airbnb and Lyft ran with it. They're like, all right, that's great. You want to call us sharing? We can accept that.
These corporations had a kind of futuristic utopian glow about them. And Harnett says journalists are always looking to write about something new. Framing these companies as new and innovative platforms helped convince lawmakers that they were different from other corporations.
Therefore, we should not be held by the laws that regulate employees because those are old laws and we're new companies. They can argue that they deserve an entirely new regulatory scheme, which is exactly what they got in Proposition 22.
In November 2020, California voters decided to pass Proposition 22. It exempts a handful of gig companies from following a state labor law so they can continue classifying their workers as independent contractors. Gig companies pumped over $181 million into this ballot measure. In their advertising, they billed this effort as a social justice issue.
Lift up your eyes upon this day breaking for you. Give birth again to the dream.
In one ad for the measure, you can hear Maya Angelou reading on the pulse of the morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Buenos dias.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Then these words appear on the screen. Every day is a new chance to lift each other up. Lyft Up provides free rides to communities who lack access to jobs, food, and basic services. Prop 22 supporters argue workers want to be independent, and being an employee would take away that freedom.
Protecting their flexibility and providing historic new benefits are what we're fighting for. Vote yes on Prop 22 to help create a better path forward for drivers.
And the measure passed. Lyft CEO celebrated, saying Prop 22 would be a model for other states. Uber and Lyft drivers and labor unions have sued to overturn it, and President Joe Biden has said he'll move to classify these workers as employees. As for reporter Sam Harnett, he still struggles to stop himself from using terms and rhetoric that paint gig companies in a favorable light.
I'm still getting to the point where I'm like, wait, why am I calling this company a startup? Like, what does it even mean to call it a startup? These terms are often loaded against workers, and the rhetoric benefits those in power.
In response to the lawsuit, companies like Uber and Lyft say voters across the political spectrum spoke loud and clear. But when the rhetoric of big tech is so loud, it's hard to tell who's doing the talking.
It's like you need both halves of the brain, right? The Jobs and the Wozniak, the yin and the yang.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
The rhetoric benefits those in power. Oh, thanks for that important report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy, and with me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. Today, we're thinking about the rhetoric of big tech.
We're joined now by Adrian Daub, who's a professor of comparative literature and German studies at Stanford University, and the author of What Tech Calls Thinking, an inquiry into the intellectual bedrock of Silicon Valley. Adrian, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
So Adrian, as a Stanford professor like us, you've obviously taught a lot of students who went to work in the tech industry. Is that what first got you interested in thinking about the rhetoric of Silicon Valley?
Yeah, absolutely. The book kind of grew out of conversations with students of mine who were, as I felt, too kind of starry-eyed in approaching these companies and what it meant to work for them and to bring about their visions. But as I kept working on the book, I felt that my students' vision or idea of these companies was also changing and was becoming far more critical. And so in the end, while I may have written it for them, I ended up learning a lot from students who went into tech as well.
So Adrian, Josh obviously has a pretty low opinion of Silicon Valley, which it sounds like you might be sympathetic to. But
yeah,
but, you know, tech is still held in pretty high regard. Like it's still, you know, considered respectable or even prestigious to get a job with Twitter or Google. So why do you think that is?
Yeah, that was one of the questions that I really wanted to address in the book. I think that there is something very interesting about the tech industry sort of being able to pretend not to be an industry in some way, right? That working there doesn't mean the same thing as working for BP or something like that. And I sort of think of it as kind of like, you know, you've heard of regulatory capture where a company kind of takes a hold of the mechanisms that are meant to impose, you know, order on it. I think of this as imaginative capture. These companies have in some ways transformed our value systems on a broad societal basis, far outside of the Bay Area, far outside of Silicon Valley, and have sort of created this way of thinking that makes what they do seem a lot more innocuous and a lot more self-evident than it really is.
But yeah, I mean, okay, look, some of our most wonderful students, some of my best friends work in tech. I mean, surely these aren't all bad people, right?
Not at all. And I should say that I am not really even interested in, like, this is not a book of sociology. I did not ask a rank and file, you know, Google employee what they thought. It's about how these industries present themselves to a broader public. And some of the most important and interesting critiques that I engaged with while writing the book come out of these companies themselves. These are brilliant people in many cases. They've thought about this and they're often deeply troubled by what's going on in these companies. You know, they go at it from a gender and sexuality standpoint. They think about how race functions in Silicon Valley. They think about how class functions in Silicon Valley, all of that. But you know, when you're opening a nice big spread about some new app that's going to, you know, disrupt X or revolutionize Y, all that's gone, right? Like if you're opening, you know, Wired magazine, or if you have a feature in your local news program or something like that, it's once again, this kind of glitzy future of disruption, failing better, et cetera, et cetera.
So when I say that, like, the tech industry or a company has a problem, which people am I attributing that problem to? Like any of them, the CEOs, like everybody who works in the industry?
Well, I think it's a mix of both, right? On the one hand, there are definitely structures that are imposed from the top down, but there is also a kind of ethos that some of these people subscribe to, often without, I think, fully realizing it. Or realizing that it's not ultimately good, but feeling they have no choice in the matter, right? Especially when it comes to questions of gender and race, right? A lot of these companies understand they have a problem there, and yet they hold on to these kind of value judgments about what's, you know, a typical techie, what counts as a tech worker, who counts as a full-time employee, who counts as working on the main business, the main mission of the company, as opposed to, you know, all the other cool stuff like HR, et cetera, that reinscribe these kind of inequalities. And so I don't think it is just about, you know, the sort of leaders of these companies. It's to some extent the fact that the people working under them accept that this is kind of plausible to some extent.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the rhetoric of big tech with Adrian Daub, author of What Tech Calls Thinking.
How does the tech industry talk about what it does? Who are their intellectual influences? And do they get them right?
From Ayn Rand to high-tech brands, along with your comments and questions when Philosophy Talk continues.
Yes, the world screams, kiss me, son of God.
Techies talk a big game. Do they think they're the son of God or something? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Accept your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about the rhetoric of big tech with Adrian Daub from Stanford University, author of What Tech Calls Thinking.
We're pre-recording this episode, so unfortunately we can't take your phone calls. But you can always email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, or you can comment on our website, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
So Adrian, you've written that techies like to quote a bunch of intellectuals, but that they often misuse the ideas they're citing. So what's a good example of that?
So it's not so much about misusing as adapting to their purposes and often kind of evacuating parts of what made that thinking interesting and generative in the first place. A good example of this is the way they sort of draw on the legacy of the counterculture of the 60s, right? Some Timothy Leary, tune in, turn on, drop out, that kind of thing. There's a lot of that sort of that's been kind of absorbed by the tech industry. And yet, of course, they have retained some of the sort of social promises of that age, but have in no way kind of made good on those. Instead, it's all about, you know, personal betterment and being better connected to other people, by which they mean, you know, your significant other, your work colleagues, or something like that. Another example is Ayn Rand, who, you know, I don't think they misunderstand her so much as that they've managed to give her this kind of almost countercultural sheen. They've given her this kind of Northern California flip-flop kind of veneer that makes her a lot more appealing than she would be if you heard, you know, about her from Paul Ryan, let's say.
I feel like she would have had deep fashion objections to flip-flops.
Yes, I believe that she's on record on this. I think she really hated the hippies. And that's what's so interesting, right? These are often very contradictory influences that sort of get bundled together in these kind of discourses that I'm tracing.
Yeah, so how do techies make use of the ideas of Timothy Leary, who, if I understand him correctly, was all about dropping out of society to do acid and have beautiful feelings and not make a lot of money?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's a really good question. There is, of course, for one thing, this anti-institutional bent to Leary's thought, right? Dropping out means largely to disengage from the institutions of society that might deform you, right? If you think about how much time we spend talking about all these, tech leaders dropping out of college, that's a very clear echo of that, right? The reason why we imbue that with this kind of totemic power is that we still think of it in that 60s way, right? And I think that that's a pretty good example.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really interesting, the way in which these tech companies often think of themselves as being countercultural and somehow living outside of the society. Some of these companies are enormous now, right? And yet they're still, according to you, and I like your thought about this, they're still seeing themselves as kind of heroic underdogs, taking on the powers that be.
Exactly. I mean, that's how Uber and Lyft portrayed themselves in the campaign against Prop 22 that you were talking about earlier. It takes some doing to think, well, we may have a valuation that's larger than most countries' GDP, but obviously we are David in this David v. Goliath scenario, right? Whereas the bad guys are taxi drivers, you know, a bunch of taxi drivers. And I think part of the interesting thing is that one of the things I didn't realize as I started writing the book, but that a fellow colleague of ours at Stanford, Fred Turner, has worked a lot on, is part of it is that the counterculture, at least in Northern California, was not actually anti-corporate. They were really anti-government, and they hated corporations insofar as they made sort of common cause with the government. They were not that suspicious, ultimately, of the corporation as a kind of self-organization. Think about it. Some of these hippie communes did very, very well for themselves, and that's not an accident. So the idea is there are some institutions that are bad institutionally, and then there are other institutions that don't really count as institutions because they're more organic, or they're more nimble, or because they're more creative, or because they're less sort of soul-crushing. And so, you know, while Leary, I don't think, would have been like, yeah, drop out and join IBM or whatever, you know, think of the targets that a lot of these people had, right? If you think of Ken Kesey, right? Like, it's the medical establishment, it's the army, it's, you know, it's the military industrial complex, it's the university. It wasn't so much your office.
That's really interesting because I have trouble separating a lot of those institutions from the tech industry. Like, the military industrial complex just, you know, has to pay tech companies to help them do their surveillance. And a lot of techies are trained at universities like Stanford. Like, we have this ongoing problem that we have so many computer science majors in comparison to the number of other majors we have.
Yeah, absolutely. It's entirely, I think, contradictory in the sense that there is, on the one hand, this idea we can do it better, and we don't need this kind of support. And yet this industry has grown up largely because of these kinds of structures, right? I mean, Silicon Valley is where it is because of investments of the Department of Defense and because of Stanford University, right? But that's, of course, how a lot of this works. Think of the fact that you know not just that Mark Zuckerberg dropped out of college, but you know where he went to college. And it's important for both Mark Zuckerberg and the people telling you about him that you know both of those things, right? You could imagine if someone didn't really care to go to college, they may not tell you where they went. But that's not how these kind of billionaire CEO dropouts operate. They both want the kind of glamour that comes with having gone to a place, and then the additional glamour of not even having had to finish there, right? There's a whole kind of vision of, you know, the underdog that's entirely divorced from class issues. The fact that, like, you know, dropping out of college, it really depends on what your financial resources at home are. There's a kind of mythology that allows people to occlude the bases on which these companies actually function and on the basis of which they actually succeed.
I want to ask more about this this idea of underdogs, which you've mentioned a couple of times. There's something right about this sort of observation that you've kind of been hinting at and making in the book, that there's a difference between being an underdog and feeling like an underdog.
Yeah.
And so this makes me think about, like, James Damore, that guy who wrote a long kind of semi-coherent screed to Google about how women don't belong in tech, and then got fired for sending this giant screed to his colleagues, and then sort of made a big deal about how oppressed he was for getting fired.
Yeah.
How do I understand this gap between sort of the amount of advantage somebody perceives themselves to have and the amount of advantage they actually have?
Yeah, I think that that's actually one of the through lines in most of the thinkers I cover in the book. There seems to be a interest among certain tech leaders and certain employees of the tech industry in telling us that the common sense picture of how power is distributed in our society, right, the way it would seem to us that the person, for instance, who signs your paycheck is more powerful than the person receiving the paycheck, is not actually right, right? That actually, you know, it's a little bit of an up is down kind of scenario, that we can redescribe the world in new ways. And I think that there's an abiding love of tech leaders, the more powerful, the better, for narratives that allow them to portray themselves as underdogs, as victims, really, as beset by these kind of Lilliputians that sort of try to tie them to the ground. right? The fascination that these companies often have with cancel culture, quote unquote cancel culture, right? That the fascination that they have with, the kind of free speech absolutism, the kind of fascination that can often exist along the lines of, you know, fascinations with wanting to advantage viewpoints that really tell some of your, you know, fellow employees that, like, you don't actually belong here. And then, you know, yelling about the fact that you're silenced if people are like, I think that's kind of insulting to me, frankly. Right. I think that that's a very strong through line that in some way, the powerless are powerful, and that the powerful are the actual victims.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the rhetoric of big tech with Adrian Daub from Stanford University. And Adrian, we've got some email. So we have one from Bob, who's a former Facebook employee, and who writes, "The issue we should be addressing is not how or whether data is collected, but how it is used and for whose benefit. There is an enormous amount of data out there. It could have been harnessed to help with the pandemic. It could be used to make our lives better. We try to prevent it from being collected rather than monitoring how it's used. Perhaps that seems impossible, but we audit companies' financial transactions. It'd be also possible to audit their data transactions. Instead," says Bob, "we throw data away, and with it, the chance for knowledge." What do you think of that, Adrian?
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I do think that part of what I argue for in the book is precisely that we need to have, as a society, we need to develop a more muscular understanding of how we can interact with tech. And what Bob is suggesting here is one example of this. I'm not a specialist in this, so I can't talk through the ins and outs of it. But the idea that, you know, I didn't want to write this book to say, you know, delete your Facebook, never go on social media again, and it's all terrible. I wanted to say, but don't let them tell you that X or Y is coming anyway, and there's nothing you can do about it. And, you know, any amount of interference, any attempt to interfere is foolhardy, and it's so new anyway. And so, like, the old systems of governance and of regulation don't work. I'm trying to say, no, let's ask creative questions about how one would regulate, how one would govern, how one would limit these companies or support them. In some way, it's this kind of mystification where, you know, the data is out there, right? It just happens to be there, and we have to deal with it one way or the other, I think is exactly something that I think we need to get away from. I think what Bob is suggesting is that data is a political site. It's a place where a society has to decide, has to make certain decisions, right? And currently we're being told stories that tell us that there's nothing to decide here. And I think that's what I'm very worried about.
Yeah. So one kind of interesting connection I see with Bob's question is this issue of how to frame ethical puzzles about tech in the first place. So a while ago, I remember there being like some academic debates about self-driving cars that focused on this thing called the trolley problem, which is an example from philosopher Philippa Foote, where you have a choice between sort of letting a runaway trolley barrel down a track and run over five people versus moving a lever that will divert it so that it runs over one person. And so then there's this question, well, if it ran over the one person, you would have caused somebody's death. But if you ran over the five people, you would have merely let them die. And does this matter? And so the thing about the trolley problem in relation to the self-driving car debate is that it kind of seemed to me like a giant red herring. Because there are lots of other sort of more pressing issues about the self-driving car debate. Like, can you get, never mind killing versus letting die. Can you get things to reliably work? And can you trust that they work enough to let them on the roads? And like, who's responsible when they kill people or let people die? I don't know. Like, how do you hold enough people responsible that it doesn't keep happening?
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting point too, right? That often the people warning us against these technological innovations tend to share with the people trying to sell us these same solutions a kind of sense that this technology is omnipotent, right? Facial recognition software is another example of this, where, you know, all these interesting ethical questions occur, and then when you talk to people in the field, they're like, "Well, gee, we're not sure that's ever going to happen," right? And I think that's an interesting question too. That in some ways we risk handing off. If we try to frame everything in these broad ethical terms, we sometimes risk the co-signing basically a kind of vision of what's possible with these technologies that are largely shaped by the people trying to sell us these technologies, right? Now, that's like going by the sales pitch that someone gives you in an infomercial. Like, you should take that with a grain of salt, you know? And I think that's another interesting thing, that these things are often messier. There's a lot more granularity to them on the ground.
I want to come back to something you were saying earlier, Adrian, about this free speech absolutism. That seems like a great case in point for getting a philosopher wrong or half right. John Stuart Mill obviously was a fan of free speech, but he also had the Hobbes principle, right? There are limits to the things we can do, including speech. So that seems like a pretty good case. Another case I really like in your book is René Girard, who's a French theorist who's really interested in people copying each other's behavior and desires, and also very interested in the scapegoat. And you make this lovely argument that talking about scapegoats is one of the mechanisms by which some people in Silicon Valley present the powerful as victims, right? Because suddenly people are criticizing that CEO for doing horrible things. That poor CEO. He's become a scapegoat. René Girard can help us understand this. Do you want to say something?
He's basically Jesus. Yes. I think that's absolutely true. And I think that this is exactly the kind of theory that really seems to have incredible pull among a certain group of Silicon Valley bigwigs. I think that there's another aspect to this Girardian theory, which I was alerted to by a brilliant essay by a philosopher that I'm a big fan of, namely you, Josh, which is, you take apart why really thinking about this idea that all desire is copied from other people can't quite work. And that article got me thinking about, like, well, why then would someone believe that, right? What's the use of them believing it to them, right? What's the utility? And one thing that struck me was that, you know, a lot of these stories also that they tell, a lot of these mythologies kind of restrict what's true of human beings, right? They often, you know, I say in the book that in the end, maybe the one place where Girard's theories might be literally true is among a bunch of, you know, young men in their mid-20s who start a startup together, right? Like, it's a way to say, if you say everybody knows or everybody wants or everybody has these desires or something like that, or this is true of everyone's desire, you know, you can say, which you do in the article, well, that's not true for everyone. Or you can say, well, then we just have to restrict who everyone is. And I think that that's often kind of the unspoken kind of sub-operation of a lot of these claims, in the sense that they may kind of work in this very restricted space. And they often serve to restrict that space and make invisible people who are very, very different and for whom this may not be true. And to sort of tell you that the very, very small group of people that you surround yourself with is the universe. You're trying to sort of set the circle very narrowly. And that seems like a problem for an industry that is, for better or for worse, affecting how vast swaths of people live, many of whom they'll never come into contact with. You need that kind of industry to have a moral imagination, to have a sense of curiosity about what other people are like. And in fact, what I found is that a lot of their philosophies tend to reward them for not being particularly curious.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the rhetoric of the tech industry with Adrian Daub, author of What Tech Calls Thinking.
How do we call the tech industry out on their rhetoric? What questions should they be made to answer? And whose job is it to ask?
Answers and accountability, plus commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. Well, of course they're going to say don't be evil. But was that ever more than just rhetoric? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and our guest is Adrian Daub from Stanford University. We're thinking about the rhetoric of big tech.
So, Adrian, we've got another email. It's from Steve in Oakland, and Steve says, Public corporations legally exist for only two reasons: to shield investors from personal legal responsibility for the potential harm of their investments, and to maximize profit for their investors. All else is nothing but public relations designed to maximize profit. Whether it's going green, stopping contributions to some Republican representatives, taking down Trump's personal Twitter account, or claiming support for free speech, nothing these corporations do is for the public good, even when the effect produces a public good. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the question to what extent this is a new form of capitalism or just a slightly more, you know, slightly different varnish on good old capitalism is a really good one. I think Steve is right to raise that question. I think that what's really kind of noticeable, though, is that, you know, for a long time, the tech giants got away with this kind of rhetoric of don't be evil, right? With this idea that we're actually making the world a better place. I think that that's what made the Prop 22 campaign kind of revealing in a way that, like, it was kind of Uber and Lyft and DoorDash and the bunch of them acknowledging, yeah, we're just basically a tobacco company, right? The same way a tobacco company doesn't want you to look into what tobacco causes in the lung, right? The same way BP doesn't want you to look too closely at the numbers on global warming. The same way they don't want you to look too carefully at who's an employee, right? Like, it's in some way, it is kind of the moment when a bubble bursts, and where we find out that, like, no, they're just like any other corporation. But what's remarkable, and what I would say to Steve, is precisely that for quite a long time, that was not taken to be obvious, right? For a long time, there were powerful actors within society, within politics, within the media that were willing to grant that there was something different about these companies. And there were people in these companies themselves who seemed to genuinely believe that.
So, Adrian, imagine that you were chosen to serve on a congressional committee and you get to ask some tough questions of big tech CEOs. What's the first thing that you'd ask?
I think one question, so first question I'd probably ask a tech CEO is, you know, you talk about things like, you know, flexibilization, and you talk about failing better and about you know, sort of creative self-expression, both for the people making these products and the people using and being governed by them. So I'd like to ask someone from Uber, for instance, what leeway does an Uber driver have to fail better, right? Sounds to me that, like, the person writing the code may have some leeway to fail better, but, you know, if a driver ever falls below 4 stars, they're basically out of the app, right? So is failing better only available to some people? And what distinguishes these two kinds of people?
I really like that question, Adrian. Yeah, I think a little bit about Sebastian Thrun, the CEO of Udacity, which is one of these MOOC companies, companies for massive scale online learning, which has a lot to be said for it. But, you know, they did a trial run for some high school kids. I think they were learning math. And they did really badly. They did much worse than students had done who were having face-to-face instruction. And as far as I remember it, this CEO basically just said, well, now that, I guess that failed and I'll do something else now, which is fine for someone in that position. I will just get a new job. But what happens to the people who are, you know, who were the sort of guinea pigs, who were the sacrificial victims on the altar of sort of, you know, move fast and break things and disrupt everything? You know, are there sort of two classes of people in Silicon Valley, the Silicon Valley understanding of the world?
I think that's true. And the second question I think I'd ask a tech CEO would be, you know, in what ways has disruption personally affected you? Because that's the other funny thing, right? They're like, well, okay, that's just our world. It's going to keep changing. It's going to, you know, destroy jobs. It's going to, you know, things are going to always be turning. And yet, disruption is a kind of chaos that always seems to miraculously not affect those in power, right? Disruption is always the disruption of other people's lives, right? There's very rarely do you hear from a CEO being like, well, that really messed with my life. Disruption is a particular way of telling a story of change. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But it can be very, very destructive and dangerous because it casts the disruptor as this rebel, as the outsider, as this kind of plucky, you know, underdog who's shaking things up. And, you know, who doesn't love a person who's shaking things up? And it also casts the disruptee, the person who's on the receiving end of this disruption, as kind of the big bad monopolist. Now, when that's about Blockbuster Video, I have no problem with that. That seems to have been a big bad company, and it, you know, it kind of sucked, frankly, right? Like, and Netflix is better, okay. But I find that weird when we start talking about, like, when like the big bad is like your local laundromat, right? Like I am, they are not a big bad monopolist.
Or a bookstore, right?
Your local the bookstore, exactly. Yeah, and I think that that's a real problem if we are deprived of our ability to tell stories accurately, but instead are fed these kind of stories that in some way distort our world and force people into these positions that they don't actually occupy.
I get the impression that there's kind of a network of interrelated illusions, right? It's not just one illusion that's being fostered, right? So there's an illusion of underdog status. There's an illusion of sort of independence. Like we don't gain anything from this society. We don't need anything. We're self-made individuals and companies. There's an illusion of novelty. You quote the Lyft shuttle line. That's a bus. You invented a bus, right? Just people reinventing the wheel, or just finding ways around regulation systems. And then finally, there's an illusion of benevolence, right? So that some of these companies sort of take credit for good developments like the Arab Spring, or at least it seems at least good at the time, but don't take any blame for Donald Trump's use of Twitter. And as you point out, there's a kind of secular theodicy. It's like, it's all going to work out. Don't worry, move fast and break things. Safe in the knowledge, everything's going to get better. Which of these do you think is the sort of the most important one, or maybe the most damaging one?
I think all of the ones that essentially, I mean, on a broad societal level, all the ones that suggest inevitability. And so I think that would be more on the side of a kind of optimism of a theodicy, the idea that in some way these changes will happen to us, as opposed to these are changes with which we will negotiate, right? Like we don't have perfect control over them, but we are also not out of control. And I think the most dangerous and the most important ones are the ones that allow sectors of society to abdicate responsibility, right? And some of that can come from very, very, from places that we might ultimately like. I mean, I often think about, I mean, a lot of people have pointed this out, right? The way the phrase learn to code, right? The idea that like that could be the solution for deindustrialization in large parts of the United States. And you kind of think, gee, this is exactly the kind of inevitability that we know that's not how this works, right? Like, what we're talking about is government intervention. What we're talking about is steering. What we're talking about is responsibility. And a lot of these myths, I think, coincide in the fact that they ultimately abdicate responsibility. And they say, this is fated to happen. Right, we're all headed towards some kind of singularity. Just let yourself drift, and don't pay too much attention to who's getting filthy rich on this and who isn't. Right, who's getting incredibly poor on this? And I think that those are the ones that we need to combat first.
So I'm wondering about some of the promise of like tech ideals that has kind of gotten lost in the capitalism of Silicon Valley. So when I think about things like the open source movement, I think, well, that's kind of democratic. The idea is that we're not individualists. You have a bunch of people cooperating and judging each other by the value of the work that they're doing and not by like the way they look or their station in society. How much promise do you think that that has, and how realizable are those ideals?
I think there's tremendous promise in these technologies and in the, frankly, incredibly brilliant people that these technologies attract, right? But I think that's where where Silicon Valley as a discursive object becomes, I think, extremely important as something that like we talk about, right? I write a lot about Silicon Valley for European outlets, and there's all these places, all these people in Europe that come to the Bay Area to find out what the future is like, right? Where are we all going? Where's the journey going? Right. And there's, of course, a couple of interesting suppositions there. Silicon Valley is where the future is being made. It's the big companies, because they don't go to like the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They go to, they go to the Google campus. Right. It's going to be in these shiny glass cubes along 101. It's going to be done by people who get fed free burritos, who are mostly white men, or at least predominantly, right? Like there are a bunch of assumptions. Why don't you go to Hyderabad? Why don't you go to Shenzhen? Why don't you talk to weird punks, coding somewhere in somewhere in London or whatever, right? Like, there are all these kind of narrowings that happen when we talk about Silicon Valley, that precisely sort of heighten, I think, those aspects of the tech industry or of technology more broadly that we've been sort of complaining about, and by the same token, often render invisible the really interesting work that people do that can't be monetized, that don't necessarily lend themselves to an awesome magazine cover, and yet really point the way forward.
On that note, Adrian, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been incredibly enlightening.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Adrian Dowd, one of our very favorite philosophy talk guests, professor of comparative literature and German studies at Stanford University, and author of What Tech Calls Thinking, an inquiry into the intellectual bedrock of Silicon Valley. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
So I'm pretty persuaded by a lot of Adrian's pessimism about the way things currently are, but I still hold out hope for the democratic potential of tech. I visiting Stack Exchange actually fills me with hope for humanity, because it's just all these individuals posting practical questions and then helping each other out, and it's massively useful. I still hold out the vague wish that net neutrality could become a reality despite the evidence. But I think that Adrian is right about a lot of the problems facing us.
And I still hold out hope for the potential of philosophy. I mean, some of these philosophers that these folks are reading have some cool things to say, like, Elon Musk quoted Adam Smith talking about the invisible hand, and Noam Chomsky, came right back to say, by the way, Adam Smith was on the side of the workers. So maybe just read a little more of these wonderful thinkers that you're reading. But this conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on the blog. Now, a man who launched 1,000 catchphrases. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, it is what it is a popular catchphrase, but is it or not? Who knows? Take, for example, Trump's crowd size. We couldn't talk about it. Donald was so prickly around it, we wanted to give him what he wanted, which changed every minute. We all got nervous, is what I'm saying, and it made us vulnerable. The consensus is that we brainwashed ourselves with QAnon and Facebook. Was QAnon contagious? That and Trump made us all freak out about the media having too much power, but it was the media freaking us out, so did it or not? Foxy Trump claimed some of the media was losing power, like the New York Times, but the Washington Post, also a loser, is owned by Amazon, which has too much power, so what is the is that is? Big tech giants, Google and Facebook, seem to convince themselves they weren't really capitalism, but something new and different. Don't be evil, move fast and break things, disrupt. Apple, bless its heart, give up on that. Yeah, we're General Motors, only with smartphones. Want to make something of it? The trouble with most big tech is it doesn't actually make anything. Google is just a big index. Facebook is a place to see what your high school thinks of the Godzilla movie. Twitter is passing nasty notes to your nasty friends that the whole class can read. Instagram is the place for people who hope to make money by being seen, having the things other people might want to have. A bigger problem is when entities do make things, it's either things we already have, like Teslas, which are cars, which I don't know, maybe we should stop making, or computers and laptops and phones, which again, we already have. Sometimes it seems like the economy is like Hollywood, but instead of making movies, they make projectors. And even when the new Hollywood does make movies, like Netflix, they seem like straight to video, only with Anthony Mackie instead of Michael Dudikoff. And we don't have video anymore. It's all streaming, which is kind of like cable television, only more expensive, and no Michael Dudikoff. Despite the big changes, everything is much of a muchness. One trouble is the lack of authority. We've talked ourselves into not trusting big government, big tech, big daddy, big mama, you name it. Smooth, authoritative voices, which often sound like the scientists in a 50s science fiction movie, helped us choose everything from atomic power to shampoo. In the 60s, we phased those voices out. Now corporations all want to be our little friend. Hi, I see you're trying to install some software. Can I help? The ads are all micro ads or chum boxes. Lose weight with this simple trick. It's all Siri up in here. Warm and fuzzy robots. And actual figures of authority, like our dentist or gynecologist, wear name tags and want to hug us. We have leached it from our lives. We try to use the voice of authority when we talk to ourselves. No wonder we're insane. QAnon wasn't a psyop or deep state prank or even a lame attempt by a corporation to create a new mascot to encourage us to buy the new bite-sized vegan wieners made from sorghum and twigs. No. Some guy came up with Q to explain how weird things are right now, even though they're not that weird. And it resonated with those of us who surf the web anxiously. And before you know it, we were co-producers of the weirdest action movie of all time. With left-wing pedophile cannibal rings and Donald Trump as the hero. Donald Trump, the least heroic man who ever lived. And in the meantime, big tech lumbers on with its concerns, the cloud, another name for a computer that's not yours, social credit scores, which you worry about if you get knocked off Twitter, Karens, they are a problem unless you accuse a Karen falsely, and then you're part of the cancel culture. Also, Bitcoin, always Bitcoin. I just read about a thing called BSV. I learned from some website that, quote, BSV is its own separate blockchain, which is hard to fork from Bitcoin Cash, end quote. I have no idea what that means, except that I'll bet that BSV stands for Bitcoin something something. Just remember, we're not clients anymore or customers. We're partners on a journey. And if you ever get to leave the house again, believe me, we won't. Why not let your phone just have it delivered? It knows what you want. It's where your KPIs are stored. You don't even need to know what KPI means. Bitcoin something bumping. That's all you need to know. Let your phone do the rest. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Jr. University. Copyright 2021.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamintuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. And Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can subscribe to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Press a button and the lady tells Aspen when it's time for bed, time to take a bath, when his mother's here to pick him up. I get to be his friend and she's the bad guy. A disrupted fatherhood.
It's visionary technology.